going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive, up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett, and I got a great episode for you with a couple great guests. It's actually a family affair, although varying sports, but sports that are real important right now in the Canadian landscape. What do I mean by that? Well, we will close the chapter on Canada's men's national team playing in the Nations League, and a bronze medal didn't end the drought of a trophy, but did make great progress as we get closer to the World Cup being here in 2026, less than 2 years away from hosting a World Cup. And although the performances were by and large good, I feel like we leave this tournament with more questions than answers. Hopefully our next guest, Cara Lang-Romero, will help us answer those questions. One of the best players, men's or women's, to put on the maple leaf, the red and white, for our country in the sport of soccer. Someone who loves the country, was cheering against us in terms of soccer in the Nations League, but Canadian fans love as well, is the love of our first guest. That would be Ricky Romero, Cara's husband. Power couple would be understating it in terms of their athletic prowess. When they do the intro, I don't know if Ricky Romero is Cara Lang Romero's husband or vice versa, because they both had stellar careers themselves. But the other part, as we say goodbye to one sport temporarily and hello to another, is opening day is here. It has come and gone, but we are super excited that baseball is back. And it's been back for a minute. It's actually been back for a couple weeks because we had games overseas. I want to talk about that with Ricky. But ladies first, we go to Hermosa Beach to talk to Cara Lang-Romero first about Canada soccer. And then we'll do a substitution, a pitching change, and we'll bring in Ricky to talk all things Blue Jays. Let's go deep.
Well, they play a robust physical game, so that's the result you're going to get. Free kick from Lang. She takes a goal. And she scores! A trademark shot from 16-year-old Cara Lang, who did this at the Under-19 World Championships last year, and she's done it here tonight to open the scoring in this game after nearly 65 minutes.
What a strike. Look at this strike. The keeper could not even keep her hands on it.
So Cara, a sweet and sour Nations League for Canada. So much to get into, and the fallout still happening as we had news of the severity of Alphonso Davies' injury today. It's not just a knock, as some people thought. It is an ACL, which means at least 6 months. And I think that even with modern medicine is a somewhat optimistic timetable. But before we get into the Davies injury, if you gave Canada its letter grade on the two matches in LA, it would be what?
Combined, probably a B plus, I'd have to say. I think it was overall very positive. Certainly the way that they ended the tournament was very positive. For me, the biggest thing was their response after that disappointing loss to Mexico, where they were clearly very frustrated with the officiating and also had a lot of bad luck as well, giving up a goal so early. I think their response in the U.S. game to come back out for something, you know, that is relatively meaningless in the grand scheme of things. It's a third place match. There's no trophy on the line. And they still came out absolutely firing. I felt like the intensity was there, which we knew it was going to be. I don't think anybody's ever questioned the willingness of this team or the intensity of this team, especially in a game against the U.S., I think what was most impressive was the quality that they brought. They really showcased their talent in this match, put all the pieces together. And even though it was a 2-1 scoreline, they dominated that U.S. team. They made them look silly for a lot of it. And I think that I was very much ready to come onto this podcast yesterday when we talked about it. And, you know, it was going to be all very positive. So it's a bit disappointing now that with the recent news that came out today about Alphonso Davies, that, you know, it's now a mess for Canada soccer, you know, another bad storyline for the CSA to have to deal with coming off of a relatively positive performance.
You mentioned that mess. And it's obviously not just the injury. It's the fallout in the comments that have come out since we've learned the severity. The full statement from Alphonso Davies, agent, Husse, is, and I quote, "I'm very disappointed. Alphonso was not 100% after the Mexico game, and it was planned that he was not going to start against the USA. On Saturday night, the expectation was he would not be in the 11. As a captain, I feel he was pressured to start the game by the coach. Alphonso is not the kind of guy to say no in those moments. He ended up playing, and look what happened. Canada soccer needs to do a better job managing these players, in my opinion. Alphonso is down and obviously really disappointed about this injury. Thankfully, he's in a wonderful hands with a world-class group at Bayern who take great care of him. He's expected to have the surgery within the next 24 hours. It was less than an hour until Canada Soccer issued their own statement to the wonderful and talented Christian Jack. We want to express our full support for our men's national team captain, Alphonso Davies, as he recovers from this unfortunate injury. Fonzie's strength and resilience matches his world-class talent, and we all look forward to fully supporting him during his recovery. Canada Soccer's coaches and experienced medical staff are true professionals and have always prioritized player safety and well-being. Anything suggesting otherwise is untrue." We are at the Real Housewives of Canada Soccer reunion, where Andy Cohen now has to litigate what the true story is between the two. I have you on because you're an expert on all things international soccer. Sadly, because you gave your body up for this country, you're also an expert on all things knee injuries. How did we get here? Why was he in the starting 11? Should he have been in the starting 11? And of those two statements, they don't compute. One side of this is clearly not adding up to the other.
No, this is a very, very damning accusation against the CSA, and I have a lot of questions about. I don't think that it's the agent's place to be making comments like this. I have to wonder if this statement was signed off on by Alphonso Davies, and if it was, that points to some even bigger issues. And I really have to question if this was not a collaborative decision. At the end of the day, you've got the medical staff, you've got the coaching staff, and you've got Alphonso Davies collaborating on these kinds of decisions. And there's protocol in place when somebody is injured. I have to question this accusation because I don't believe that there's any way they wouldn't have done some kind of fitness test for him to make sure he was okay to play. And I think that it's also hard to say, you know, that this injury led to the ACL. Yes, there is research that shows that weakened hamstrings can increase your chances of a torn ACL, but ACLs are an epidemic in this game. So there's no way to know if the hamstring injury caused the ACL injury. Also, when doesn't he have a niggling hamstring injury? When hasn't he stepped on the pitch without a nagging hamstring? So you could say the same thing for every other match he's played for Canada recently, that there was risk. And then we're talking about the risk as well. Like, for this agent to come out and say this, does he not understand that this is a risk that everybody accepts? This is part of it. This is, you know, there's always a risk of injury when a player is released from their club to play for their country. And I just think Alphonso Davies has been playing professional football for a very long time at this point. He may be young, but he's been a professional footballer for long enough to be able to know his body and to understand the risks. And I can't imagine that he was forced onto the pitch in any way. It's true, there were questions of his fitness heading into it. And I wouldn't be surprised if the decision the night before was that he would not be playing and that somehow along the way changed in the morning. But I don't think that that decision was all Jesse Marsh's or all the medical staff's. I think that Alphonso Davies had to have been a participant in that decision. And so to point the finger in this way, it's questionable to me.
So many questions, because from my vantage point, neither of those statements come out without multiple eyes on them. And in the fashion that they do come out, I think they're probably quite sanitized. I think the real feelings on both sides are probably a little bit more cutting than what we actually read in print. And if I'm Alphonso Davies, my agent works for me. He works on the best interest of me at all times. It's literally his only job. And if he's going to say something that I don't agree with and sign off on, that is a problem. And I find that to be either highly problematic or highly unlikely. And then on the flip side, if you're Canada Soccer, you had multiple options for who your captain was going to be after Atiba Hutchinson bowed out of the international game. Alistair Johnson would have been an easy choice. Many thought Stephanie Stacchio was the leader in the clubhouse because he had worn the armband previously when Atiba wasn't in matches. To me, you give a shout to Alphonso Davies to be your captain. One, because he's your best player and you think you might get more of him and more ownership over the entire group if he's wearing that armband. And two, because you want to be aligned with him on all things moving forward. And this is the opposite of alignment. So the fact that he's injured is obviously a blow. The fact that this is messy and Canada Soccer can't get out of one tournament without the conversation not being just about the football is a blow. But even the relationship between these two parties, if you will, the Federation and its best player moving forward, to me is unsettled at best now, no?
Absolutely. I think that this is messy, messy territory that we're getting into. And I am unsure what the motivation in this situation is either. Like, I get it. Even then, it's not necessary, but I get it. You're in contract negotiations, and so maybe your agent makes a statement to use as leverage at some point. But what is the motivation in this case to drag Canada Soccer and Jesse Marsh through the mud? It makes no sense to me. I understand that Alphonso Davies is probably very emotional in this moment, probably very angry and upset. I've been there 3 times. You want somebody to blame. I'm not sure, as I said before, if this is his opinion or if these are his statements being relayed by his agent. But at the end of the day, that is your representation. They are representing you. So I'm sitting here waiting for one of two things, either Alphonso Davies to confirm that this was his agent speaking for him, or for Alphonso Davies to come out and refute his agent's statements. And in that case, he should be firing that agent, because this just makes the situation a whole lot worse for everybody involved.
Yeah, you wonder if, you know, some of the pressure and maybe the disappointment came from Bayern, who just put pen to paper on giving him a lot of money moving forward. He's in a third place game in a region that isn't as respected in Europe as it is in other places of the world. And maybe their frustration towards the agent caused the agent to lash out.
But you said it, DJ. It's a third place match. And that's where I lean more towards giving Jesse Marsh the benefit of the doubt, that why would he put his captain, his best player, and a player who Bayern Munich just paid a big chunk of change to, why would he put his career in jeopardy for a third place match that really, at the end of the day, doesn't mean that much? I lean more towards giving Jesse Marsh the benefit of the doubt that he wouldn't do that. I find that very hard to believe.
The devil's advocate to that is that if you're a manager, every match means that much to you, especially when you have very limited windows to work with these players. And one of these teams was going to leave the Gold Cup in fourth place without a win. And we knew going into this game, it was either going to be the United States or Canada soccer. And going into hosting a World Cup with that being your last performance, I can understand that there might be pressure to turn up and have a positive result and have, you know, on any given day, even though it hasn't always been that case for Canada, but by and large, your best world-class player in the 11. I think that's the flip side. As much as, and we'll sadly, shortly, get into the United States, and it seems like their indifference around playing in a third-place match, I think the flip side for Jesse Marsh would be, I'm going to leave here with something, and I want a result. He had comments going into the game to Matt Schinetti of TSN around his changes, and although there were only three, they were allowed three, I would argue. He was forced into a fourth when Davies didn't make it past 12 minutes, but he mentioned the need to manage the amount of players on a 90-minute load multiple times. Mm-hmm. And so you think, okay, he has that in his mindset. If you're thinking about that for theoretically Kyle Larin or Stephanie Stackett, wouldn't you be thinking about that around Alphonso Davies, who, to your point, has had hamstring injuries?
I imagine so. And I imagine that's why the conversation the day before the match was that Davies would not be playing. That was the information we had received as well. So on that point, Davies' agent was right that was, from what we had heard, the decision leading into it. But we don't know what the conversations were like after that point between Davies, the medical staff, and the coach. We can only speculate. And who's to say, again, that it wasn't Davies who put his hand up and said, I am good to go. And this has been a conversation about Davies for a while now, just about the pressure that he clearly puts on himself to put this team on his back. And we see it in the way that he plays, in the way that sometimes he forces things. And not, this isn't, you know, necessarily a criticism of him, because I think it's admirable the way that he wants to be the leader for this team, and you know that he wants to be the guy, and he is the guy. But at some point there has to be a conversation about where you draw the line, and the fact that there is a ton of talent on this team that can be relied on, and that he doesn't need to be the savior all the time. So maybe this is sort of within the same conversation. Who knows where that pressure is coming from, because maybe he's putting it on himself, that pressure to play when he's injured and to carry this team on his back and do everything all the time. I think that that's something that needs to be examined and something that needs to be talked about going forward, especially if he's going to remain the captain.
This is why I love talking to you, because all these things are connected. And if you look at this team under Jesse Marsh, Jonathan David has taken his game to another level when he's had service. 6 goals and 3 assists, and so 9 goal contributions in the 14 goals the team has scored. We can talk about the fact that they need to score more than 14 goals, but that all can't be on the back of one player. Alphonso Davies has not been his best self. We have to go back to World Cup qualifying, where, you know, he plays outstanding against Panama. Obviously, he gets the lone goal in the World Cup. But since, he's the first name you're going to write down in the team sheet, but he hasn't been the player that he's been in the Champions League, quite frankly. Is he playing in the right position for this team at this level? Because everyone has said he is one of the best outside backs in the world. That's where he should be playing. And I get that, but he seems to want to take the ball and take on the entire team when they do have other options behind him, assuming full health, which wasn't necessarily the case in this window. And I do feel like if he was closer to the final third to start having the ball, we might see more of a threat that we've seen from him in years past.
I'm not sure, because I think a lot of the issues are him taking on two and three players in the final third. So whether he starts further up the pitch or starts on the back line, unless there's sort of a change in mentality, that problem would still be there. I think to take him off of the back line would probably do more harm than good, just because right now this back line is unbeatable in many ways. You know, from left to right, this is definitely the strongest back line, in my opinion, in the region. And I think having Alphonso Davies on that back line does strike a lot of fear into opponents. And I think maybe that's part of the reason why he did start. And again, just speculation. But for me, my first thought when we heard that he may not be starting was, oof, how much confidence is that going to give to the U.S. team, knowing that they don't have to go against Davies on that Canadian back line? Now, at the same time, you've got Cornelius, you've got Bombito back there, and them alone, you know, I said it after the match, like, what an asset they are to this team, and what a nightmare for defenders to have to play against them. But then when you add Johnston and Davies on the left and right, I just think that that's the one clear, or it was until Davies' injury, that was the one clear spot on the field where you knew who your guys were. And I don't know if I'd want to mess with that. I don't think that that's necessarily the issue. I think the issue is more just Alphonso Davies not taking that extra touch, you know, getting rid of the ball a little quicker and then maybe getting it back. It's versus what we've seen from him, which is trying to do too much and trying to take on three players when he doesn't need to, because he's got a ton of talent around him.
I'm not allowed to argue with you because you've forgot more about soccer than I will ever know. I just feel like you could put Richie Larea or Sam Adekube at left back, and you could have Tejan Buchanan on the right and Alphonso Davies on the left, and just say, go, you racehorses. And if Jonathan David is going to come deep to get the ball, they can stretch teams and run in behind and just terrify defenders for the better part of 90 minutes. But I know nothing. thank you. I do know this, though. You talk about the solidity of that defense. And although that is true, I think there's a huge question mark. A team's most valuable defender for me is their goalkeeper. And Dane Sinclair was clearly given the gloves in what we thought was still an ongoing conversation and competition. And listen, of Canada's three senior goalkeepers, if we want to put McGill in this conversation, only one of them is really playing for their club right now, in Dane Sinclair. So as much as we can talk about depth at that position, I mean, you need depth of people who are in form. But is Dane Sinclair in form? He saw five shots over the course of two games, which I would take walking into the tournament. I think that's theoretically good defense. And he let in three goals. And at least two, I would say, he would want back. Is this now done and dusted? He's the keeper. He's big. He's athletic. He's going to be the guy moving forward. Or is it still an open conversation?
It looks that way, doesn't it? Jesse Marsh choosing to start Dane Sinclair in both the first and second match, even after looking back at that first match against Mexico where he didn't set the wall up properly. There was a huge hole for Jimenez to curl that ball around the wall. You could see it on the players' faces standing in the wall after it went around them. They turned around and realized they were in the complete wrong position. But it doesn't seem like Jesse Marsh held that against him. I think because he is Jesse Marsh's clear favorite, that's what I took from that situation, because I did expect to see Crapo get a chance, especially in a game against the U.S., because as somebody who has been covering LAFC, my first thought goes to, who's the guy who's willing to lay it all out on the line? we know it's Maxime Crépeau when it comes down to it. He is willing to sacrifice life and limb, literally, for his team. And so that in that situation, maybe in a grudge match like it was against the U.S., I would have gone with Maxime Crépeau, but I'm not the head coach. And clearly, Jesse Marsh is looking ahead to 2026, and he clearly wants to get his as close to his starting 11, I think, out there in one of his last competitive matches. So at the same time, I get why Dane St. Clair, if he's the guy that Marsh is looking to have as his number one, why he would choose him. Also, he fits the profile of what Marsh clearly historically prefers for a goalkeeper. He's a huge guy. So it just makes sense that's who Marsh is leaning towards. But personally, as a fan of Maxime Crépeau, I would have liked to seen him have a chance to at least make a case for himself.
One of the big questions as we get closer to 2026 is this team does not have a set piece coach, and they are not good on set pieces going in either direction. As a football person, I feel like it's just weird. Like, you would never just go into a Super Bowl without a special teams coordinator. It's something that they're working on and reportedly they're hoping to have done soon. But you've played the sport. Is that of huge value? Is that a minimal thing? How big of a deal is it that there is, as of taping this, no set piece coach for the senior men's national team?
It matters. It definitely matters. Set pieces are absolutely crucial, especially in major tournaments. I think one area where they have it down is the long throw. Alistair Johnston's long throw was completely destroying the U.S. team. And I think that just sort of shows where they were vulnerable and where Canada could have taken advantage of them in other set piece sort of situations. You know, they treated that long throw sort of as a set piece. If they could have applied those same principles to their actual set pieces, I think that they really could have capitalized against the U.S. They were unprepared. They hadn't been very good at defending set pieces throughout the two matches. So I think it was a missed opportunity for Canada. It's clearly, and they've talked about it, it's something that they are working on and something that they've got a year now to perfect, because you can't go into a World Cup without having your set pieces in order.
So going into the World Cup, if you had to pick starting 11, give me two things. One, who are the locks right now that when Jesse Marsh goes to bed, he knows, assuming health, these guys are coming out of the dressing room for game one with a jersey on, not with a windbreaker? And two, where would you, if you were on his staff, fill in the gaps? What would your preferred 11 be?
Oof, this is a tough one, DJ. Especially now with the injury to Davies.
Are we assuming
he's back?
I'm assuming everyone is healthy. Okay. And he's got over a year. So mm-hmm. as much as I think 6 months is not insignificant, and you've had to do it, but I think in over a year he should be back. But actually, before you give the 11, get into that, because everyone it has reported, 6 months, okay, let's cut the calendar, he'll be back this date, and you know he's just going to run into the field and be the same player. Without fitness in that time, without real match scenarios, still a young player, without touches, without forming relationships with teammates, club and country, how detrimental is this injury in terms of the growth of the player?
In terms of the growth, that's a hard one. I think some people come back from ACLs and they're better than they were before the injury. A lot of people come back and they're never the same. It's very hard to say. Another thing that his agent did get right is that he is in good hands in Germany. A lot of people from North America go to Germany for surgeries and rehab for these kinds of injuries, among many others. So that was my first thought when it happened was, well, you know, at least he's getting the best of the best in Germany. They know what they're doing. It was always the German or the Norwegian players who we were like, what? She came back in 4 months from an ACL? That's unheard of. But it is unheard of. So I think 6 months is optimistic. It's not impossible. It's probably looking more like 9 months by the time he's back to game fitness at an international level. again, optimistic. I'd be shocked if he wasn't back within a year. I think, you know, I don't think there's should be a concern that he won't be back for the World Cup. But yeah, it depends. There's so many factors involved in these injuries. What else did he injure at the same time? You know, it's not always just the ACL. It's all the damage around to the cartilage and any other ligaments that were affected. You just don't know. So until a full report on, and they won't know until they open up the knee and they see exactly what happened. And you just never know how a player is going to react. So we can only speculate. It's a very nuanced injury at the end of the day. But I don't think that we are unrealistic in projecting that he will be back in that starting 11 eventually in time for the World Cup.
So that's one lock. Give me your other locks.
Same back line. I loved what I saw from Bombito and Cornelius. I think that their partnership is outstanding. I think that the way they read the game together is unbelievable. It's not just about athleticism for those two. They are elite defenders. And then Alistair Johnston. I mean, I can't, if I was a coach, that's the kind of guy you want on your team. And even seeing him switch to the left side somewhere he's never played before when Davies came out. He was pretty tentative playing the ball with his left foot. He kept cutting it back to his right foot, making me nervous. But at the end of the day, he did a fantastic job back there on the left side in that game against the U.S. So that's my back four. Midfield is a little bit questionable at this point just because Chouanière looked really good. He looked really good. I liked that change. I liked seeing him in there. I know the change was made because, as Jesse Marsh said, he was trying to manage the minutes for Eustachio. And I know Eustachio is the guy. I expect to see him starting by the World Cup. And then Kone, I think he sort of, it was a bit of a missed opportunity in that first match against Mexico, but I think he did the job against the U.S. The way he absolutely manhandled Weston McKennie and Tyler Adams in the midfield, I think he did a wonderful job against them. And I think that he's somebody that Marsh can rely on. I think he's only going to get better. You and I have talked about it. I talked about it leading into the match. This is a guy with so much upside. He has yet to reach his potential. He's got a year to get closer to it. And I think that he's going to really factor into that squad by 2026. I think Jonathan David, that's like, there's no question there. He will be starting up top. It's really who starts alongside him. And a lot of that will come down to if we see Promise David or, Promise David didn't get cap. He wasn't cap tied. I wish we had seen him a little bit. So it's hard to say. I'm really just going off of, we don't have anything to go off of as far as him playing for this national team, but we've seen what he can do at the club level and he's a very impressive player. So I'd like to see more of him. But in the meantime, Oluwaseyi, he did the job too against the U.S. You know, it was for me important that he got on the score sheet in that game. Like I said, after the match, just showing how deep this team is. So I think it's probably Jonathan David and Oluwaseyi for now, unless Jevison and Promise David prove otherwise in over the summer. And then the wing, it's tough. That's tough because Buchanan really showed out. He really showed out in that match. I think he was instrumental, pivotal, really, in that second goal, Jonathan David's goal. And he was just running that U.S. team ragged on the wing. Ali Ahmed, it's hard to leave him off the pitch because he's so versatile. He can play on the right or the left. So that for me is tough, but I don't think it's a problem for Canada because I think they've got a lot of depth on that wing right now. And I don't think you can really go wrong with a lot of those options.
A lot of great options. I don't know if Mauricio Pochettino has many good options right now or if he even wants to be in the job. by the time 2026 comes around. If an offer from the Prem comes into his inbox, if he might just say, I don't need the $6 million a year. I'm going to go back to the UK. If you had to underline what the issue for the men's national team is, given all the success, both on the field, but just in terms of popularity of the women's national team, what would it be? Because I feel like at times the women's national team, you know, aside from, I suppose, when the president wasn't really happy with them, have been the darlings of the country. And I feel like the men have been loathed, not just by the country, by like some of the former players. And now, given the crowds, I felt it's gone from hatred to apathy around this team. What are the issues with the U.S. Soccer Federation on the men's side?
Well, first and foremost, I think to view this tournament as a spectacular failure for the U.S. is pretty accurate. Three-time champions, you know, of this tournament, all the talk heading into it was that they were the favorites despite the U.S. or Canada actually being the favorite in this tournament. But just because they had won it three times previously. And there was so much excitement around Pochettino, especially coming off of their win against Jamaica, where they were so dominant. That was the first time in a while where they had actually had some flow in the way that they played. And everybody was like, this is it. It's here. Look at this, like basing it off of that performance. But you have to consider, like, that was against Jamaica. They're not a very good team. What's that going to look like against a Mexico, against a Canada? I mean, we saw what it looked like against Panama, a team that they should definitely be beating, but they had no answers for, absolutely no answers for how to get through that back five. I just think that this, it's hard to pinpoint what the problem is. And sitting in that post-match presser, listening to Pochettino, he didn't have an answer either. There was literally not one single tangible reason for why they were underperforming. All anyone can point to at this time is a lack of intensity, a lack of desire, but there's got to be something tangible. And I'm still waiting for Pochettino to come out and really get into the details of what went wrong and what his plan moving forward will be. I just think that it's hard to say whether somebody is taking the job seriously or not. You know, there's a lot of criticism for Pochettino of whether he's even taking this seriously or whether he even knows his players. And it's true, some of his substitutions were questionable. I was sitting there going, like, does he even know who's on this roster or what they offer? But at the end of the day, I don't think that's where we should be leaning. I think I just have to assume that Pochettino knows the gravity of this situation and knows what's on the line. I mean, he took on a job to coach the hosts of the World Cup. He has to know, he had to have known what he was getting into and the importance of it. I don't know if he quite understood how deep the problems in this team run. It does seem like the issues are quite big. And, you know, I think that there's a massive chemistry issue within this team. I sit there wondering, like, do these players even like each other? Are they on the same page in any way? You have to question when you see Pochettino trying to make a sub and Pulisic is refusing to come off the pitch. I mean, for me, that just points to a lack of respect. And something has got to change in that situation. There had to have been words after the match about that. You could tell Pochettino was visibly frustrated that Pulisic refused to come off the pitch, especially because he was insisting on taking a free kick when his free kicks, not just in the past two matches, but for the entire cycle, have been abysmal. So you kind of wonder, like, what's the case he's trying to make here about why he needs to be the one to take that free kick? But yeah, I think that this U.S. team leaves this tournament with a lot more questions than answers.
I think everything you said, you could also say maybe about CONCACAF. I think people were stressed about this, not a good sign of the World Cup coming. But newsflash, people are going to buy tickets to watch the World Cup. That's not a threat. But CONCACAF didn't seem to know their audience. The games that didn't include Mexico looked like there were games happening in COVID with social distancing. I wasn't interested in getting jiggy with it with Will Smith. I don't know why Nations League and Gold Cup theoretically has to be in America, but this is what we've been given. And then there's the officiating conversation that is a constant one in CONCACAF. Is this an issue the region is having, or by the time 2026 and the World Cup comes around, this is all going to be forgotten?
I think by the time the World Cup comes around, this will be forgotten, because that's like a FIFA production. You know what I mean? Like, it's FIFA takes over, and the issues that run deep within CONCACAF will not be center stage at that point. I also think, for me, having played in CONCACAF for so many years, you have to expect this. We have never known anything different. There were moments in that game against Mexico where the Canadian players were visibly frustrated, and I get it. But I do think that they were spending a little bit too much time arguing calls that they should have been expecting before that first whistle blew. You have to know that that's what you're going to get, especially as Canada. You are never going to get the calls in your favor. So I don't know if we talk about apathy. I don't know if I'm apathetic at this point because of all the experience that I've had in CONCACAF, and this is just what I've come to expect. And you know you are going to be up against it, especially wearing that Canadian jersey in CONCACAF. Doesn't make it right or just, but it is the way it is. So obviously there needs to be changes and improvement, especially when it comes to officiating CONCACAF. It was terrible. So inconsistent. But I think it's also just, it's the way it is, and it's the way it's always been.
It has. Although I will say, the USA-Canada game, I thought, was officiated quite well.
Oh, yes. She did a much better job than the official against Mexico.
I think we just assigned that we need female officials, full stop. Jesse Marsh clearly didn't believe so, because he got himself a red card and will now miss a match, and got his wrestling exit out of the stadium with the camera following. So it's funny. Jesse Marsh has talked to his team about being prepared for what happens in CONCACAF, and yet he was the one shown a straight red. Unless he was doing that strategically to fire up his team, it built to a point where he just momentarily lost his mind. I'm not sure I'm with him on the penalty shout that he got tossed for, because that was the least credible one of the three.
It was. There was no doubt that that was not a PK. David slipped. There was no contact. I think it was the compounding of all of, you know, the missed PK call in the game against Mexico, the one previous in the game against the U.S. Emotions were running high. I don't think that it was premeditated in any way, but I think that Marsh may have made a meal of it when he realized, you know, at this point, I've lost my cool. I've probably already got a red card. So at this point, let's just use this situation to get my guys up. I don't think that it hurt the team in any way for him to be sent off. At this point, it was very clear at that point in the game, that team was Canada was playing with so much confidence. They all know their roles so well. They had already come out of the first half absolutely flying. They ran that U.S. team into the ground for the first 10 minutes of the second half. So, and plus they've got a staff on the bench that they know and trust, who were interim coaches before Jesse Marsh was hired. So I think he knew he was leaving the team in good hands. I think he knew that the mentality was there for the players that was not going to drop in his absence. So I don't fault him in any way for taking that red card. I think that as Mario Biello said in the post-match presser, that it actually may have galvanized the players. I think he's spot on with that comment. And I get it. I mean, I was never a fan of the refs either, so I can't hold that against him in any way.
I just felt like in that moment, as he was spazzing on the touchline, I was just watching him, but really watching my eldest son, Desmond, have a tantrum, and just had, you know, my wife Kate's voice in my mind, like, what is this tantrum really about? Like, clearly it's not this issue. Like, yes, Auntie Cara does make you gluten-free waffles, but that's not happening here today. So what is this tantrum actually about, is how I felt about Marsh. Lastly, I want to know, what are you most excited about now that we are literally a month away from the NSL starting in Canada? We got kits. We have streetwear and clothing wear partners in Simons. We got all the things. We have a hype video on Instagram with the girl punk rock. We have a league. Like, this is not an idea anymore. It's a real tangible thing. The thing that excites you most is what?
Seeing Canadian fans in the seats to watch a Canadian product on the pitch for the first time ever at the club level, and just seeing the excitement around that and growing the game in Canada in this way, and seeing young girls in the stands finally able to see what the future holds for them as well. I can't wait.
I can't wait as well. I will be in the stands consuming and watching and cheering. You will be some version of either on a desk breaking it down, or at home streaming it in the beautiful confines of your Los Angeles home. Either way, probably crying like a baby. But I can't wait. It's going to be so, so fun. Thank you so much for breaking this all down. This was fun, Cara.
Thank you, DJ.
Thank you so much to Cara. You can find her on IG. Cara Elise is the handle, K-A-R-A-E-L-I-S-E. And you are going to be able to see her, as she is going to be part of the first week of broadcasts of the NSL here in Canada. She set a high bar. We'll see if Ricky can reach or succeed it. Let's go deep with former All-Star for the Toronto Blue Jays, Ricky Romero.
Breaking ball, bounce to Romero. Two quick outs here in the first.
But you know the talent is.
Another bouncing ball right back to Romero. Nothing to it in the first for Ricky Romero. 1-2-3, first inning.
He's quieter. His head stays still a lot longer.
Strike three call. Joe West with the very delayed strike call. Good fastball gets Delman Young. First strikeout of the night for Ricky Romero.
They have great plate coverage.
Swung on and missed. Ricky Romero turns it over, racks up a couple of strikeouts. It's quite an adjustment when you come here. Cut on and missed. Romero strikes him out. Ricky Romero has three strikeouts on the game so far. They were one of the few teams that was thrilled to go on the road. Romero strikes out Cadena with an off-speed pitch to start the fifth. Imagine that things would lead to 1992 and 93 back-to-back World Series.
Well, he always had that position players, if you don't get them early in the draft, the real good ones, you're not going to get one.
Well, you talk about a real good one right there. Ricky Romero strikes out Joe Mauer with two runners on and one out. What a great pitch he throws to Mauer.
Good time here for a changeup.
Exactly what he throws him. The Dyer said he foul tipped it, but Aaron Sebia hangs on for the strikeout. That's strikeout number 7 for Romero.
All right. We have to break down all things baseball, as baseball is finally back with my buddy, my good friend, one of the best Blue Jay starters I've witnessed with my own two eyes, Ricky Romero. But first, I have to begrudgingly give you your flowers. El Tree. El Tricolor. Is that how you say it? Either
El
way.
Tri.
Mexico. How do you say?
El Tri.
El Tri. El Tri. The national team is once again the kings of CONCACAF. Got some help from the official and no help from VAR, but over the balance of 180 minutes was by far the better side. I have no question. Just go ahead and flex. Go ahead.
No. I'm not going to flex, man. You know why? Because as we've seen, the ship can turn quickly, especially the way it's gone lately. Obviously, as I'm sure as you and my wife talked about, I hope it wasn't so much about a penalty not being called, because if we're going by that, you know how many times we've seen Mexico get screwed in a World Cup, Netherlands, never forget that, Noera Penal, all that stuff, man. I've had to live through that. So one for the good side, it means a lot. And but honestly, it was fun, man. It was cool to go to SoFi and witness that atmosphere for the Mexican team. Obviously, there was a lot of talk about the crowd not being such a factor for the U.S. team and stuff like that. But when it came to Mexico, they showed out, man, and it was fun to watch.
They saved the atmosphere of the entire proceedings because it certainly didn't come from the home nation. We didn't actually talk really about the penalty that wasn't. We actually spent more time talking about the fact that Jesse Marsh spazzed over a penalty that shouldn't have been one. but it was a conversation in Canada around the potential USA and Canada matchup. People thought it would be for gold and not for bronze. And what the tournament would mean off the back of the Four Nations tournament in 3 fights in 9 seconds and 2 intense games and a golden goal by Connor McDavid and everything that meant in relation to the tariff war that's happening between the United States and Canada and the country of your ancestors, Mexico. It's a big deal in Canada, so much so that I feel like it's overblown how much the players would actually care. These are players who are young and many of whom playing in Europe. I don't know if they're out here reading the Globe and Mail every day the way I am. But from Mexican side, many Mexicans who, one, live in the United States,
yeah,
or two, even, you know, those players on the national team have family in the United States. How much of the geopolitical aspect bled into the proceedings for them? Because it's a bit of a dual issue. It's the tariffs, yeah, but it's also the ability to move freely for Mexican immigrants within the United States.
Yeah, no, I think it meant a lot. And I think that's not that was a highly motivator why it probably sold out on the final. But I mean, I think anytime the Mexican national team comes to LA, it is a spectacle and something that I wanted my oldest to experience in Sebastian. We stayed to both games on Sunday. We watched the Canada-US game and he wanted to go home because there was like an hour and a half intermission. And I was like, dude, I just want you to experience this atmosphere. I want you to feel the energy of this crowd, and it's going to blow your mind. And thankfully, we stayed through the first half. We ended up leaving at the second half, but I wanted him to see it just so that, what did my sister texted me something, because she goes, it's so cool that Sebastian is getting to experience this and seeing the Mexican side of things. And it's a party, man. I mean, I feel like anybody, even if you're not Mexican, the atmosphere, the party that the Mexicans bring, the music, the dancing, and just all of it, and how much it means. And we know, we probably know that Mexico, us fans that root for Mexico, we probably know that they may never win a World Cup, but the illusion is always there that they're going to win it one year, you know, and we've been heartbroken so many times. I remember back in the day, sitting in our living room and watching the World Cup and how much it meant to my mom, my dad, and my family members who came from Mexico. And I think that's why it's been ingrained in me that, you know, those colors mean so much. Me personally, I still have my jerseys from the WBC that never happened for me for Team Mexico. I was supposed to be playing on the 2012 team, and they send me my jerseys and everything, and I have them here. They never have been worn, but I know how much it would have meant for my dad, for my mom to be able to put those colors on. And And yeah, man, I mean, it's just special. I think it's just something that everyone has to experience because Mexicans do know how to party, that's for sure.
Yeah, the cool thing about that area and that state and really that city is in many parts of America, when you come from elsewhere, you're forced to become American. It's different in Canada where you're encouraged to bring your culture. Not in California. You are American for sure, but you are very much still Mexican, and it's beautiful to be able to get that little piece of Mexico and the culture within the U.S. And you and everything you did in your career was a great example. That speaking of it, I assume the country not only celebrating a Nations League, they're celebrating what's happening for your boy Kirk. He's bringing a lot of pesos back to the homeland now.
Yeah,
as he's the face of the franchise now. He's locked up longer than anybody else. If you would have told me a couple years ago, when they had Danny Jansen and Gabriel Moreno and obviously Kirk, all for short stints, but all at times up on the major league roster and certainly in the pipeline. With you know, Moreno being a top prospect in the sport, if you were to tell me back then that the last man standing, or I guess crouching behind the plate, would have been Kirk, I was like, no way, there's no way. But here he is. What do you make of this deal for him and for the club?
I love it, man. I got to play with his younger brother when I ended my career in Mexico for the Toros de Tijuana. And I had heard about Alejandro, and it's such a cool story, man. If you go back and listen to it or read about it, he was a guy that wasn't even being scouted. The scout that was there to go see a different player, and he came upon Alejandro Kirk, and that's how they signed him, the Toronto Blue Jays. And just to hear the story, obviously he's from where my mom's from, Tijuana, Mexico. I mean, Baja California, that's where he's from. And I feel like when I met him, we connected so quick. And just like you, man, if you would have told me he'd be the last man standing out of the names you just mentioned, and Jansen and Gabriel Moreno, I would be like, you're crazy. But here he is. He's worked hard. And, man, to get that kind of contract and listening to his quotes and him talk about how he wasn't expecting it kind of reminded me a little bit of what I went through. I remember being called into spring training and saying, hey, we want to sign you to an extension. Never in my mind was I expecting that. And it kind of seems like he wasn't either. But, man, when you lock up a catcher, a guy who's been to All-Star games, who's won Silver Slugger Awards, and, yes, I mean, a little bit of a down year last year, and you're banking on him, you know, being the reliable force, do I want to see a little bit more out of him? Absolutely. I think anybody does. I want to see him catch more. You know, I want to see him be a workforce behind. And I think he has that clear path now where, you know, before it was Danny Jansen, he had to split some time here and there and stuff like that. I think now this is his team. He's the catcher of the future, and he's the guy that they're going to rely on catching 100-plus games, hopefully, and being that reliable force. We see the metrics of what he's able to do when he catches, you know, the strikes that he's able to get for his pitchers, the leaders that leader that he is for those pitchers. And I feel like all the pitchers from starters to bullpen guys have nothing but great things to say about him. And, you know, every time I talk to him, he's so quiet and very reserved, but I know deep inside him, as he said in his press conference, he said that he wants to win, and he's doing this because, you know, he believes in this organization. He never thought about free agency, and this is the place where he wants to be. And I think anytime you have a player who's committed like that to the city of Toronto, I mean, it's not easy, DJ. I mean, we've heard it from the basketball side, a bunch of guys coming out now about all these things about Toronto and this and that and customs. And it's such a tired narrative, in my opinion. Like, first of all, we fly first class. We fly through different airport entries to meet with customs, and you're never really, it's so quick. It's just the fact that that's even a narrative, in my opinion. It's like you take away from all the beautiful things that the city of Toronto has to offer and the country of Canada, honestly, when it comes to fans, how much they care about their teams and, you know, ultimately, like any other fan base, they just want to see their teams win. And I think, you know, when you have, when you have players who are committed to staying here long term, I think it means a lot to the fans.
It's such a sore issue with me. I wasn't planning on going there, but you just open up that door. One, to all the idiots online who are like, it's 81 games a year on the road. You got to go through customs. It's 41 games a year on the in NBA, NHL. You got to go through. No, it's not, dummy. Because you go on what's called a road trip where you leave once and you come back once. So you're not doing it that much, number one. Number two, do you think Mike Trout is out here taking off his shoes and taking off his belt and taking off his taking his laptop out of his bag? Do you think he's doing what we do to go through customs? No, it's an entirely different side of the airport. It's an entirely mm-hmm. different world, entirely different treatment. So if you're annoyed, you have to fill out a card quickly while you're on a plane. I don't really know. I don't know what to tell you. If you'd rather live in, name your flyover state in the U.S. that outside of game night sucks, if you'd rather live there than Toronto because the border is super secure, I just don't have a lot of sympathy for you. It is a tired narrative, but sadly, it is one. It's big in basketball,
and that's the number one thing that the people that didn't play, they're just, you know, friends of mine, they're like, the first thing they ask is always like, how is it going through customs? I'm like, what? Like, how is that? Like again, like you mentioned, it's you go through a different line, you're treated a little bit different, you know, because at the end of the day, sometimes you're arriving at midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, just like any other team would. If you're flying from the West Coast to the East Coast to New York, you're still getting in. Yeah, you don't have to go through customs, but it's not like it takes a ton of time. It's like they check your passport. Hey, ask a few questions. Boom, you're through. And again, when it comes down to it, I'd rather be part of a, you know, the one team in Major League Baseball who a whole country watches rather than a city. Yes, the Dodgers are popular, maybe the most popular team in the world right now with Shohei Ohtani and the Japanese players that they've brought on board and stuff like that. But when it comes to the love, and even post-baseball for me, when I go back and being part of the alumni team with the Toronto Blue Jays and stuff like that, you feel the love, man. Like, I don't think that happens anywhere else. Maybe, yeah, for the Yankees, for the Dodgers, but you tell me that if you're an alumni of, and this is no knock on other teams, but like the Chicago White Sox, you think they get the same treatment as you would going back to Toronto and the fans, you know, cheering for you and stuff like that. There's certain levels to it, as we like to call it. And I feel like, you know, me playing for Toronto was, I mean, I can say this comfortably because obviously my wife is from there, but it is honestly one of the greatest blessings to ever happen to me. I don't take it for granted. And I was just in spring training 3 weeks ago and doing some alumni events and just being part of it. Even people, you know, that fly from Canada to go watch the Blue Jays and just being able to interact with them and stuff like that, you still feel the love, man. I haven't suited up for the Toronto Blue Jays in, I don't know, 12 years. And it's still, you still feel like you're still part of the team because they make you feel like that.
Dude, if I was being paid millions of dollars, I would be cleaning up those little plastic bins you got to put your stuff in. I would be the most excited to come through customs to get my check. Are you kidding me? It's just,
yeah.
There's, as you say, there are levels to it. You talk about that though, and I think for Blue Jays fans, this makes the next conversation even more frustrating because there's another player on the team who speaks Spanish, who you've connected with right away, and his name is Vladimir Guerrero Jr. And he is a A1 world-class player who came through this system. His family has ties to the country. He has citizenship if he wants it. He has communicated that he wants to be a Blue Jay, given how difficult it has been historically and most recently to get A1 players to want to be a Blue Jay in free agency. The fact that you have one right here, fans are uber frustrated that the deal is not done and whether the deadline of spring training is real or imagined, they wanted this deal done yesterday. I ask you from a player's perspective, when you are in a scenario where there's interest in both sides, but also you know that your franchise has been willing to risk it all financially for other free agents and have struck out, are you then going into those negotiations feeling like, I'm not interested in a hometown discount? Because I've seen you threw those models and the financial projections to the wayside when you wanted to get a deal done with players you had no relationship with. You should do the same, if not more, for me. That's how I would be looking at it if I was Vladdy, but I'm also super emotional and petty. You as a player, what's that like, knowing that you have your negotiation with the team, but also people talk, you know what the negotiations are like for other players at your level?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And it's for me, you know, I'm always going to be pro player, right? I mean, I'm always going to be on the side of the player and making sure that, hey, you get what you're worth and what you deserve. And I think with Vladdy, I mean, it's an interesting case. You really do hope that the clock is ticking, and you really do hope that it's something does get done here in the next few hours, and you avoid this whole mess of free agency. Although he's come out, you have to sit here and wonder and say, man, I wonder if he's been doing these interviews where he's talked about free agency, and now he's like, I'm willing to listen to the Yankees. You're wondering if he's using all that as leverage and putting more pressure in on the Blue Jays organization to say, hey, this is what I want, meet me here, and let's get a deal done. Because it is true, they've swung and missed with Soto, with Ohtani, and I mean, it's no secret the numbers that are out there. And when you're looking at yourself in the mirror and you're saying, I'm the face of this franchise, and I think I deserve this, and this is what I'm worth, then you have to kind of stand by that. And obviously you want to be able to work with the team, but also, like, it's as a player, you want to also maximize like what you're worth and not make sure you just don't sell yourself short. And I feel like Vladdy isn't selling himself short. He's confident in his abilities. I think where it went wrong is they could have done this a long time ago. It could have saved the Blue Jays millions and millions and millions of dollars if it would have been done maybe after last season or something like that. And all this could have been avoided. But, you know, Vladdy is a generational talent. And getting to know him and how much he cares and what the city of Toronto and the country of Canada means to him. I mean, we all know his father's history with Canada and Montreal and stuff like that. To me, it would be hard, man. It would be hard to see him play in another city for another team. And, you know, my youngest son or my oldest son continues to ask me if Vladdy's going to be there next season. And I wish I could say yes, but I'm like, dude, honestly, I don't know. I mean, things happen. Sometimes players move on, and he still doesn't understand that. And he even said, well, if Vladdy leaves, I'm not going to root for him anymore. So he's a little bit confused on how free agency works and all that. But, you know, and you know that I feel like with Vladdy, again, I think that you hope something does get done. And if something doesn't get done by tomorrow, I mean, I feel like that seems to be the deadline. I think you're going to see him go into free agency, and, you know, it's going to be a bidding war for the Toronto Blue Jays. And who knows if this is the last season we see him in a Blue Jay uniform.
Sebastian, we all don't understand it. You have millions of Blue Jays fans who don't understand it, because tomorrow's price is not today's price. And if he does hit the open market, whatever they're talking about now, it's going to be more.
Yeah.
And there is no alternative option coming in the system that's going to give you near the production. You talked about being players first. I want to get your vantage point on this and those Dodgers, who have, in my recollection, on paper, when you just look at resumes, the most impressive grouping of starting pitchers that we've seen play together. I know, like, there's some Braves fans who are screaming right now about the amount of Hall of Famers they had at the same time. I get it. But this is a group that, assuming everyone's healthy, and we might not see everyone healthy at the same time with the volatility of starting pitchers, but this is a group that goes six deep with starting pitchers that could be, in many cases, opening day starters for other teams. How do you manage this? Do you ride the hot hand? Do you go with a bigger rotation? Do you just hope that someone is injured all the time? You guys are alphas, and you want the ball, and you want to get in a rhythm, and those off days matter, and you want to stay sharp. How are they going to make this work?
Yeah, man, it's an interesting case, and it's a good problem to have, because unfortunately we know that in baseball there's always injuries, right? I mean, and some of those guys have been injury prone. Tyler Glasnow, Blake Snell, at times can hit the IL at times during the season. But when it comes down to it, man, they have the perfect guy at the helm in Dave Roberts. I think that's he now he's getting his flowers because of a World Series championship and stuff like that. But for a while, they criticized everything that man did. And knowing baseball, watching baseball from a different perspective than, you know, fans and stuff like that, I always defended him. And I feel like he's the perfect guy for this type of clubhouse. I think everyone understands what needs to be done, who's in that clubhouse, the amount of stardom that's in that clubhouse. And there's no better guy, honestly, to lead them. And I think Dave Roberts has dealt with that since the first day he stepped foot here in Los Angeles as the manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers. And there were so many expectations back then. And I think the expectations are even bigger now. I mean, you add so many stars, and, you know, you bring in Roki Sasaki, you bring in, you know, I'm drawing blank right now. Who am I thinking of? Anyways, yeah, you bring in all these stars. Oh, Blake Snell, that's the other guy. You bring in these guys, and to make your team that much better than what already it was last season, it just becomes one of those things where now you just kind of let them go out there and perform. As far as a six-man rotation, I mean, I'm sure some kind of analytical department will tell you that that's the right thing to do to keep these guys healthy. But who knows? I mean, it'll be interesting how they navigate it throughout the season. Maybe one starter piggybacks the other and vice versa. So we'll see. It'll be interesting how the Dodgers go moving forward with it.
Perfect segue to bring me to the next thing I wanted to get your point of view on is analytics. And we've got to a place where it is a true outcome game. Strikeouts, home run, there's very little artistry in the game. I would say it's over analytical, and it's not as if we're in the era of Moneyball where the analytics was the curveball to the way the game was coached and managed and played in the past. Now everyone is playing the game with an aspect of analytics. Is that hurting the performance, given that everyone's trying to do the exact same thing, but also the production value in terms of watching a game that, you know, at best is a little quirky and is not as predictable?
I've gone back and forth with this a lot, and I've always said, you know, analytics are good. You know, they're good when you sprinkle them in, but the game of baseball is a game of baseball. I think it's still in between the lines. It's unpredictable, you know, for pitchers. Sometimes I've heard current pitchers say, yeah, they want me to do this more, they want me to do that more in a game. But at any given start, any given day, your arm may not feel the same as it did 5 days ago. Your curveball might not be as sharp, and it takes a while. And so sometimes where the analytical departments, I think, go wrong is we're like, oh, you got to throw this pitch, and you got to do it here. And there's certain counts where you got to throw it and this and that. Well, what if that pitch isn't working? You know, and I think it the game of baseball has always been a game of adjustments. You adjust within the game. And but I'm good. I'm all for it when it comes to like, hey, is it going to help me get over the hump in certain situations? I listened to Jose Ramirez's podcast, and Jose Ramirez is probably one of the greatest third basemen in the game of baseball right now. And he said it was pretty funny because they asked him like about the analytics, and the first thing he said was like, when I struggle, he said it in Spanish, when you see me struggle and I hit under 200, I'll listen to your analytics. Till then, I'm going to continue to do it my way. But the day that I struggle, I'm open, I'm all ears. And they've left me alone since. So I thought that was pretty interesting, right? I mean, I think sometimes if it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know, just leave it alone. Like, just leave the game of baseball alone. We already have enough rules, enough stuff where, you know, I think some of the stuff is good for the game. Obviously, we've seen, you know, games go a little bit faster with the pitch clock and stuff like that. Some guys are against it. Some guys like it. I mean, it's all just natural preference, whatever certain guys like. But regardless, I think at the end of the day, analytics are good. To a certain extent, there's a time to work on analytics. But once the game starts, man, it's hard to sit there and crunch numbers. And this is going to work better because this will give you better odds and stuff like that. Baseball isn't played like that. Trust me. Like, I wish it was. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, sometimes it's the hot hand, the hot hitter that gives you the big base hit and stuff like that. So I've never knocked analytics or anything like that. I think when you sprinkle them at the right time, with the mix of just letting guys go out there and be big leaguers, I think it's a great thing.
I do like some of the changes. I like the fact that baseball, which is a very old school sport in many ways, is open to change, which some sports, quite frankly, aren't. But we can't just have people just walk into second base without earning it. That's where it's too far. That part bothers me.
I agree with you. I mean, I think they've made it easier for the base stealer. I mean, the fact that, you know, I feel like it's always the game of baseball has, especially when you're a pitcher, it's a cat and mouse game, right? Especially between you and the hitter. And now when you have a runner on first base, it turns into a cat and mouse game between you and the hitter and the runner at first base. And I think when you take that aspect away of like, hey, you're only allowed to pick over three times, then it kind of takes a little bit away from the game. So, yeah, I mean, there's certain things that I don't like, and who knows if they'll ever be back to normal, but that's kind of what you have to adjust to right now. And there, like I said, I can sit here and knock on these things and this and that, but it does no good. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you have to watch it and you just have to kind of live with it.
And in extra innings, just being able to put someone on second, like, do we have to get this game over because we're at a community field and the lights are going to turn off? Like, what are we doing? Let's have you earn the run if you're going to win it, and not just have these, you know, house league rules. We talk about the game and its health. My last question for you is big picture on the health of the game, because I will say that as much as people are excited for opening day kind of happened. It happened in Asia in the middle of the night in North America where no one was watching, and it certainly wasn't talked about on all the talk and debate shows. People were talking about Nations League and the NCAA tournament and, you know, whatever the Lakers were doing at the time. I fear with the ESPN MLB deal going away and all of that coverage and prestige that, yes, starting the season makes sense. Because there are huge fan base and now many Asian stars in MLB. But I do feel like you have to work to earn the spot in popular culture among the other sports. And I fear that baseball's fading further and further in the background in driving that conversation. And if you're not going to have that conversation when your season starts, how are you going to get it in the middle of summer with a season that's so long? That's my fear. But I also am looking at it from a Canadian perspective. You have a much more global viewpoint on the game. What's your fear on the health and viability of the popularity of the sport, given that games have already started and people have no idea what happened with the Dodgers' first games?
I mean, it's definitely concerning, and because I feel like opening day is such a big deal for every city that has a baseball team. And you're right. I mean, the fact that it was in Asia, in Japan, and, you know, Otani, Sasaki, Yamamoto, those guys going back, along with the players that the Chicago Cubs have, it's big. It's big out there, yes. But the fact that, like you mentioned, I mean, I wasn't able to wake up and watch that game. I mean, I didn't even catch the highlights. Everything's just kind of like you go on social media and you read about it and you see who pitched and you see what happened and stuff like that. You do worry about it a bit. I mean, you know, you have a guy, a commissioner in Rob Manfred, who has ruffled a lot of feathers and amongst the players. And you hope that there is, you know, there continues to be growth. And, you know, I'm watching it now at the 9-year-old level, DJ. Honestly, I mean, you watch, you know, what's going on in baseball locally here with travel teams and this and that, and hammering your kids into thinking that, you know, they're going to be big leaguers and this and that. And it's a great dream. But at the end of the day, I think at the end of the day is you got to let your kids be who they are. And at 9 years old, the last thing you should be thinking about is dedicating yourself to one sport and having, you know, private instruction left and right and all that stuff. Like, yeah, it's good to have, you know, I mean, my oldest, Sebastian, like, it's good to have, like, my hitting abilities go to a certain level. And if he can hear it from somebody else, that's awesome. I'm all ears and open to somebody else taking him and stuff like that. But there's never going to be pressure of like travel ball and we got to do this. And I think it just starts at the youth level of things of, you know, of kids getting burned out and not, and hating baseball. And you kind of lose fans in the game of baseball in the grand scheme of things. So it just starts with us as parents at the little league level, and you just hope that they love it enough to, you know, even if they're not big leaguers or anything like that, they continue to be fans of their teams. And I mean, if you ask me, I mean, my two kids, they love rocking their Blue Jay gear here in Southern California. They're probably the only two boys who do that. And it's awesome to watch them love something that means so much to me. And that's kind of what I want from the game. Like, hey, I want to be able to take you guys at one point to different stadiums and go watch the Toronto Blue Jays in different stadiums. And I feel like that's how you grow the game, you know, and from a younger level up onwards until the, you know, when the fans who pay their tickets to go watch the Toronto Blue Jays and stuff like that, you never want anybody to lose the interest in the game of baseball. And you hope you know, it continues to grow and we continue to grow it in the right way. I mean, again, losing ESPN obviously is pretty big, but, you know, nowadays we have the MLB network that you can watch baseball nonstop and stuff like that. And for me, opening day was always such a big deal. And the fact that I got to start in two of them for the Toronto Blue Jays was even bigger. And I think if my kids understood the magnitude of that, I think they'd be pretty impressed, because so far I don't think anything about my career has impressed them yet. I think it's just normal. I mean, my oldest still asks me how hard can it be to get to the big leagues, and when I mentioned the number that, you know, there's only about 20,000 players that to ever played in the big leagues, he still doesn't quite get that. But yeah, man, I mean, opening days is always special. And I think, you know, hopefully with the young superstars that we have worldwide, we continue to grow the game. You have guys, like I said, in the Dodgers, San Diego, you have Vladdy in Toronto, you have Juan Soto in New York, and guys like that. I mean, it's just Francisco Lindor in New York as well from Puerto Rico. I mean, so if you continue to grow these guys globally, I think it makes for a better product, and you'll continue to capture the fans worldwide.
I remember when opening day felt like a holiday, and I don't want to lose that, because there's two opening days. I know financially you got to grow the game internationally, but I think you got to make sure the game grows domestically as well. And if your kid questions how real you were, just tell him to get in the batter's box and just throw something high and inside and let him feel what it was like to go up against his pops. Hey, man, I always appreciate this. Love talking to you. I love that you kept the Mexico gloating to a minimum, and you didn't come as hard at all of Canada as you did at me in our group chat. much appreciated. But you're right. You know, these things are cyclical. And when the Lakers flame out in the first round of the postseason, I certainly will be drafting a text coming your way. So just look forward to that in a couple months.
No, man, it's always fun to join you for some cool conversations. It's cool to keep it everything in perspective, right? I mean, we talk about the game and growing the game, and it's true what you say. I mean, let's put our focus into growing it here and continue to grow it here and then expand from there. obviously no issues in growing it outside of the country. That's awesome. It's great. But we have to make sure that we continue to have huge fan bases here and the game of baseball continues to grow bigger and bigger.
Until opening day next year starts in Mexico, and then you're all for it. Then you're going to be there throwing out the first pitch. It'll be a time. Maybe the Blue Jays will be there and Kirk will be behind the plate. Hopefully, maybe. If the Blue Jays are there, Vladdy Guerrero Jr. will be there also. But TBD, as always, as it happens, I'll hit you up for your perspective. And we can't wait to see you up north sometime throughout the season.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to East LA's pride and joy, Ricky Romero, also the pride and joy of Toronto Blue Jays fans. Ricky Rowe 24 is his handle on IG. Give them both a follow because they're both outstanding humans and live real interesting lives that I live vicariously through them, which is why I follow them on Instagram. Okay, we're going to take a short break. That was a lot. We're going to reset, regroup, and maybe dive a little bit even deeper into all things baseball in Blue Jays and MLB. Part of Apple's coverage of Major League Baseball once again this year is Alex Faust. We go deep with Alex next.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And we have another year of Blue Jays baseball on Sportsnet, both radio and TV. Our own show, Ali, is part of the radio coverage, so make sure that you're listening when you are not watching. And actually, you can listen and watch at the same time. One of the cool aspects of Apple's Friday Night Baseball, produced by MLB Network, the Emmy Award-winning production gives you some choices. Some people love the camera angles and the state-of-the-art immersive sound and spatial audio, but they want to hear some of the familiar voices around the team. One of the cool things you can do during Apple broadcasts, if you are a fan across the USA or here in Canada, you have the option to listen to home or away local radio broadcasts. So you could be watching on Apple and hearing the likes of our Fan 590 broadcast team, including obviously Show Alley, or you could just watch the game as normal and hear the wonderful call of our next guest, Alex Faust, who's going to be here, we hope, quite often, because that would mean the Blue Jays are relevant and in contention. Does Alex think they will be? Let's go deep and find out. So Alex, another season. It's a national holiday, certainly, for baseball fans, whenever opening day comes and goes. But the real conversation and the Google alerts that Blue Jays fans have is around Vladdy Guerrero Jr. and whether or not he's going to hit free agency or sign. There's a conversation in terms of who the face of the sport might be, but he's certainly the face of the Blue Jays. You're outside the market. What do you make of the stalemate that we have with a homegrown player and a team that has shown that they've been willing to be aggressive in spending to get free agents, even though they haven't landed a big one yet?
I think that's a great word to use. And granted, you know, not knowing the negotiations and the particulars of what's going on with Vladdy Jr. and the Blue Jays, it feels like this season and maybe subsequent seasons for the Blue Jays hinges on, can they get this guy signed? Because I don't think Blue Jays fans and I don't think Blue Jays ownership wants to go through this season with the cloud of his pending free agency hanging over the team. And that's not to say they can't get a deal done. I mean, the Mets, you know, granted it was a bridge deal with Pete Alonso, but that was hanging over the Mets all season long. And that even went into the trade deadline last year. Remember, oh, will they trade him to, because he's a, you know, UFA. And so what's going to happen? You know, the sooner they can get a deal done, the better. I know it's rare to see in season any sort of big, you know, agreements like this done. But I think it will determine a lot the direction of this franchise over the long run. Are they fully in? Are they committed? Because right now they're they can't negotiate, or the Guerrero's camp can't negotiate with anybody else. It's the Blue Jays and nobody else. And until he hits the market, the Blue Jays are negotiating against themselves.
The team in the last couple off seasons has famously been a bridesmaid and not a bride when it comes to landing some big free agents. It would hurt even more to the fan base if they lose their own homegrown star. In terms of when you look across the league, front offices, is there a group that's under more pressure than the group in Toronto?
Yeah. You know, we've seen the renovations to the ballpark, and there's an expected return on that investment, no doubt, from the folks at your parent company. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's a question of where do they see this team structurally? I think it's built around power bats, and a guy like Guerrero, a guy like Bichette, and bringing in a guy like Anthony Santander to a long-term deal. Is that a smoke signal that they're prepared to move on from Vladdy Jr. by bringing in slugger like Santander? I don't necessarily think so. I think they've tried to build this team in a certain way to play a certain way, and especially with the reconfiguration of the ballpark, even in recent years, they've been built to play a certain way. They just haven't been able to execute it. I mean, remember a couple of years ago, right? This was one of the highest scoring and top slugging teams in baseball. And the last couple of years, you know, trying to build around that in the same exact way, it's fallen flat. So the question is that identity, is that structure going to work here? Because I think there's a lot to like about this Blue Jays team. I think there's a lot to like about their pitching staff. I think there's a lot to like about them defensively. But are you going to build yourselves around being a slugging team primarily? And that's a question that they have to answer. And this obviously will get settled one way or another.
I love that you mentioned Santander, because I think he's someone who hasn't been mentioned enough. There's a fan base who was hoping for Ohtani, was hoping for Soto, and they got Santander. They're like, meh. But there's a real useful player in there. For those who haven't seen him up close and personal yet, who are just starting to pay attention after spring training, what are the Blue Jays getting in that player?
They're getting a guy who plays both sides of the ball really well. And I think even the structure of the deal, never mind the deferred salary, but even the total and the length of the contract, you're talking about a guy in his prime just coming off a breakout season. I mean, this is a guy who absolutely should put up similar numbers to what he did last year in Baltimore. He stays in the division, so he's familiar with pitching staffs. He's familiar with ballparks. So there are no question marks there. And now you have protection in the lineup for Bichette and for Guerrero. So in a lot of ways, there are no excuses for this team anymore, because some of the question marks ever since they traded Teoscar Hernandez were about, can they get protection around Bichette and Guerrero, and some of the moves that they made just didn't work. And granted, some were, oriented a little bit more towards defense, but this is absolutely geared towards making the Blue Jays lineup as fearsome as it was a couple of years ago. And I firmly expect that it will be. And it should unlock Bichette a little bit more too, especially after his struggles last year.
Now I want to go a little bit wider and big picture in terms of the league, because you get to go to so many markets and get the temperature on the sport. I found it interesting that in basketball, there's this ongoing conversation. Who's the face of the league moving forward, and who should that be? There isn't really much of a conversation in hockey. You know, it's been passed from Ovechkin to, and Crosby now to McDavid and others. In football, it's the star quarterbacks. In baseball, I mean, Vladdy is the star of this market, but if we had to say who the stars, the faces of the league are, do we have a unanimous name or names?
I mean, the two that would come to mind would be Ohtani and Judge, biggest market, and two, fearsome power hitters, phenoms at their respective positions. Those would be the first two that come to mind, and I get that, there's an implication there too, that Vlad Guerrero Jr. could absolutely join that conversation. Maybe there, part of it is, the bias with the border, right? In the U.S., we're coming at it with a different orientation than for one nation, one team with the Toronto Blue Jays. And absolutely, Guerrero is carrying the flag for Canadian baseball right now. We see so often that when players jump into different markets. That's just the reality of the sport. Attention will change. You know, Shohei Ohtani, yes, he was a phenom playing for the Angels, but let's be clear, the Angels are always going to be number two in LA, no matter what you do. And now that he's on the Dodgers, it's, you know, transformed this guy, never mind what he's done on the field, to a new level of international superstardom that is beyond anything we can comprehend. I mean, look at the TV numbers they just did in Japan for the Japan series. I mean, it's off the charts. It's not even close to, you know, the attention that we get here in the States for regular season games. And I get it. It was a special event. It's, you know, and especially with the Japanese players that were featured as part of that two-game series. But it's a phenomenon at another level with Ohtani and, you know, Judge playing in New York with the Yankees. Can Guerrero get to that level? Toronto needs to build a winner in order for that to happen.
When we were kids, some of the faces of the game were pitchers. The star ace was a big-time star in the sport and pop culture. Not so much anymore. The game has changed. But could Paul Skeens be that? Could he bring that back, given how quickly he started and how dominant he's already been?
I hope for his sake, because he's such a great person, that he can be. I fear that the team around him will not be good enough while he's in a Pirates uniform, and that it may take some time for him to reach that level, because he needs to be on a winning team. I think that's just the fact of the matter, that you need to be on a winning team consistently. It can't just be a one-year deal either in order to reach that next level. I would love to see that. I would love to see, you know, the return of the, you know, staff ace who can go deep into games. I was actually just having this conversation with somebody the other day that the whole idea around max effort pitching has shortened the career spans of so many pitchers because of the damage they're doing to their arms. We don't have guys who have staying power as much anymore. I mean, the idea of getting a guy like a Verlander, you know, it's they don't come all that often anymore. And that's a shame in and of itself, because he's a star. When he was at the peak of his powers, he was absolutely one of the faces of baseball. But, you know, I hope, you know, for the sake of the sport too, because I think you're right. I think that, you know, when we were growing up, you know, you had some of these guys, Roger Clemens comes to mind, you know, a guy who wore a Blue Jays uniform and pitched in big markets and in, you know, big games, Randy Johnson, Tom Glavine, right? Like, these guys absolutely were the faces of the sport. And because the nature of pitching has changed, where guys are not going as deep into games, they're getting hurt more often. How many times do we see a year and a half gap between, you know, because they're off with Tommy John surgery, right? Like, that's not a way to run a business. And I'm a little bit surprised even that the players union hasn't voiced more of a concern about injuries and the way that pitchers are expected to be max effort guys coming up through the minors, because your labor force is getting damaged. Your earning power is getting impacted by all of this. So, you know, that's touching on a broader, you know, bigger picture discussion for another day, but I think you touched on something, that the era of the dominant star pitcher being the face of the game, the face of a franchise, it's not happening right now.
Well, when you look at the draft, as soon as a pitching prospect is drafted, the first thing that's said is what he touches on the radar gun. DeGrom has come out and said, maybe I'm better off at 96 or 97. And I don't need more. He's doing that reactively because of the injuries you mentioned. Do you think we'll get to a place where pitchers are doing that proactively?
I hope so. I mean, there was a great story in The Athletic recently about pitching labs at colleges. And, you know, it's a whole different kettle of fish when, you know, they're trying to get guys to shape their pitches with these high spin rates. And that has its own deleterious effects on, you know, the health of arms. But I do think we're reaching a breaking point in some ways with the game, because we see so many pitching injuries, and because kids in high school are coming up thinking, because they have family advisors or agents already telling them, oh, you gotta be hitting this number on the radar gun in order to get noticed. Well, what about being effective at actually pitching and pitching to contact and winning games. I mean, that used to matter. It should still matter. You know, I'm a layman when it comes to the analytics side and how, you know, the value of a strikeout is, you know, you'd much rather have that than any other outcome if you're a pitcher. Just like a couple of years ago, right? The idea of a home run is the easiest way to score a run. So why not swing for the fences, right? It's the same thing going on in pitching, that the most effective way to get an out is by not letting the batter touch the ball. Well, the downside of that is that we have a lot of pitching injuries and teams, you know, have more of a challenge in managing their labor force because they have to get their way through it. I mean, the Orioles right now are starting the year with, what, four pitchers that are injured, two of them are coming off Tommy John surgery, right? So, you know, their entire staff is going to change mid-season because they're going to get guys back. So it's what's best for the players, what's best for the game, and keeping the game in a healthy state.
I think the competitive games obviously would help. And I look at the Dodgers and I feel like there aren't any holes. The volatility that everyone has around starting pitchers, they have some contingency there with the amount of great starters that they have. When you look at them and look at the competition across the league, are they the prohibitive favorite going into this year? Is there an obvious hole they have that I'm not thinking of?
No, it's obvious. Sometimes it's staring you right in the face. It's back to back or bust. That's the way that I'm kind of viewing it for that team. The amount of money they've invested, even after winning a title, the fact they've doubled down in so many ways, it's unlike anything we've seen in modern times, really. I don't think, even going back to those Yankee dynasties, it wasn't as if they were, you know, committing, you know, tens of millions of dollars more after winning their championships. They had a core group that they worked around, and certainly, you know, they added free agents from time to time. Clemens actually comes to mind in a lot of ways, right? But the Dodgers, this is a different level of spending. This is something like we've never seen before. And they figure if we've got generational talents and the ability to attract even more who might even be willing to take discounts to be able to play on this super team, you got to go for it. And I don't blame them one bit.
I get it. It totally makes sense. And as we say goodbye, the last question is, what is success for the Blue Jays? Back-to-back is success for the Dodgers. What is success for the Jays in 05?
You got to get back to the playoffs. You have to get back to the playoffs. It's as simple as that. You know, I don't pretend to have a finger on the pulse of what would be, you know, a successful outcome in the postseason. You know, obviously getting swept out in the wild card round doesn't do you very much. That's two extra games. But you have to get back there, period.
Well, we love that you're coming back, Toronto, to start the season. We hope we see a lot of you throughout the season. Thank you so much, as always, and have a great call.
Appreciate it, Donovan. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks so much to Alex, and it is at @Alex_FAUST. @Alex_Faust is the handle on X. Also worth a follow. Thank you so much. We have so many choices this time of the year in the sports calendar, and always, quite frankly, of what you listen to. It is an honor and a privilege that you choose this and that you made it this far. It's because of the strength of our guests, so I thank them once again. But I thank you for listening. Please like, favorite, share, subscribe, and review. Thanks for listening.